morning and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Sarah Gustavus. 2017 was a year when many of us grappled with hard questions about race, politics, and identity. Some say it's because the media and social media are highlighting divisions across the country. Others will say it's because national politics are pinned on dog whistle rhetoric tinged with racism and xenophobia. National policies have been enacted that affect Muslim Americans, refugees, and immigrants. DACA was ended this year. President Donald Trump still says a border wall is a top priority. Culturally, we've also seen a rise in white nationalism and white supremacy. But there are also folks who will tell you 2017 is actually nothing new, and this country has always been racially divided, and that reality has always influenced policy, either subtly or outright. Today, we're doing something a little different with the show. We won't be taking any calls. Instead, we'll spend the hour looking back at some of these stories and how New Mexicans are dealing with these issues. We'll hear from New Mexicans who were affected in a deep way by decisions made at the national level. And we'll hear from people on the street about how this racially and culturally charged year affected their lives.
My name is Santiago Herrera. I think it's much more racially charged than before, and I think in New Mexico, how it affects New Mexico, it affects it the same way it does the rest of the country. You know, here, especially here in New Mexico, we are truly a melting pot. There's so many different races here. And I don't ever think I ever felt racism in this town, but it seems like that's changing now than what it used to be when I was growing up. When we didn't hear from all the white nationalists, everybody just kind of assumed it was gone. And now it's here and it's everywhere. If you see it, say something, do something, because it exists. And the more we just try to act like everything's perfect, it just continues to grow.
KUNM's Marisa DeMarco is in studio with me. She's a reporter here at the station, a lifelong New Mexican, and she's seen firsthand the shifts locally as people around the state navigate how these national policies and conversations impact them. She's covered these issues throughout the year. Good morning, Marisa.
Good morning, Sarah.
First off, it was a year of protests, demonstrations, and marches. In January alone, there was the Women's March and anti-Trump protests around the inauguration. Remind us what was happening here in Albuquerque.
The Women's March was huge, and it was unexpectedly large. There was thousands of people there. We also saw during the inauguration, there were marches downtown, there were marches at UNM, and then also all around the state.
And some of those little communities, I remember that really got my attention because you're going to be really obvious to your neighbors if you come out and protest in a small community.
Absolutely. That caught my attention, too. And also the rural areas of New Mexico. It wasn't just happening in big cities. It was kind of all over the state.
There were also water protectors protesting at Wells Fargo. Why was that?
They were encouraging divestment. In January, it was still a little bit before the eviction of the Standing Rock camp out in North Dakota, but there were people here who were taking actions at Wells Fargo, at the bank, and then also at the Army Corps of Engineers offices here in Albuquerque, and they were really still hoping that they were going to be able to prevent the pipeline from going through.
Yeah, they're going after the funding to try to make their voice heard. The airport protest in Albuquerque was a response to the first attempt at a travel ban, an executive order that Trump signed in late January. That was quite a large group of people that turned out.
Yeah, all of these demonstrations, I think especially the Women's March and then this airport demonstration, were the biggest that I've really seen. I've been covering protests for years. There's a couple in my mind that stand out over the last decade as being big, but we have seen a lot of really big ones. And this one had a bunch of families. It was very multicultural. People were carrying signs that showed their faith, too. So it really felt like a lot of different aspects of people's lives were coming into play in that demonstration.
I would describe it as pretty calm. People were out there expressing their opinions and their voice, but there wasn't a huge police presence. Things went pretty smoothly. They walked up right up to the airport, and then there was a demonstration inside where people come in to go up to the TSA screening.
It was also, as I mentioned, notably multi-faith, and I spoke with Annalisa Madrid about Christian values and refugees.
We're supposed to welcome with open arms the people who are hurting, the people who are needy, people who are seeking refuge, and it just totally goes against that. And I mean, like, religious persecution is real, and Christians experience that in other parts of the world. We shouldn't be inflicting that on people here.
Welcome here, no hate, no fear. Muslims are welcome here, no hate, no fear.
I also met Ilaf Al-Tamimi there, who came to the U.S. as a refugee with her family, which was fleeing Iraq when she was still very young.
I'm blessed every day for the life I get here, because if I was there and I was in war, I probably wouldn't be alive because the war was going on in our village, and I'm just so blessed. So this means the world to me. I didn't even expect all these people to be here. It's amazing.
You checked in with Ilaf Al-Tamimi again just a few days ago to look back at what the year was like for her as the Trump administration tried to implement this policy.
We met at the beginning of this year, and you told me a little bit about your family history. Remind me again the story of how you came to the U.S.
Well, we came as refugees. I was literally a month old when we came to America, so I was pretty much born here. I usually say I'm born here, but all my other siblings were born here. And ever since then, I've been in America. It's just my home. Thousands of people were dying, and we left with nothing. Like, we didn't even have our paperwork. I still don't have, a real original birth certificate because I was just a month old. My mom just had me, and we just left, ran out, literally, in the middle of the night.
And you go all the way from that part of the story to today, where you're a student and a medical assistant here in Albuquerque. It's a long journey, right?
Yeah, it's a long journey. I went back there for a couple of years in 2011. I was literally stuck there. I just came back in January, right before the ban, when he proposed the ban, when I met you. So I went back to go visit, and my passport expired, and then all of a sudden ISIS started happening and all this war on terror, and I couldn't risk driving 6 hours to Baghdad, where the U.S. embassy is. I couldn't risk my life or my children's life to get new passports. So I was stuck there for 6 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I just came back, but I am still going through some hardships here, but I'm just really thankful I'm here.
Some hardships related to the travel ban?
I work in the hospital, and one time a patient's parent told me that he didn't want me in the room. I was like, what? He says that I freak him out, that I scare him. I feel like Trump doing this, he's just putting fear into people's hearts. He's giving them a reason to fear us, which isn't fair because I'm just as American. I work with very educated people and sophisticated people, and somebody before, a couple months ago, made this comment to me saying, oh, your name is Ilaf. What would your name be if it was American? I'm like, what? What do you mean? I am American. Why are you separating me from you? I'm just as American as anybody else here. This travel ban is separating us. It's belittling us. It's taking away from our human value, our rights. It's very unfair.
So tell me about what you were doing back there in January at the Sunport. Why were you there?
Oh, I was there giving my support because I am a Muslim woman. I am an American woman at the same time. And we need to stand up for our rights as humans, because not letting someone in a country because of their religion or because where they're from, that's not American. People come to America for freedom. Where's the freedom if they're not allowed? Where's the freedom if they can't come here because of their religion? What does that say about America?
And you mentioned then that you were so surprised and glad that so many people had come out to the airport. Did that feeling kind of hold for you this year?
Oh, yeah. I see on the news and online all these people that aren't Muslim, that aren't from those countries, standing up for us. And it does. It means so much. There's hope. Albuquerque gives me hope. America gives me hope for my future, for my kids' future, for our lives. Because if I wasn't here, I wouldn't know. I would have probably been killed in the war back there. But I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy for everybody that supports us and that doesn't judge us.
It has been so up and down with the travel ban this year. The White House pushed out some different versions, and then it would get tied up in court. What's that like for you? How does that impact your life?
I feel very oppressed as a Muslim woman, and it hurts because I don't want to be labeled. I'm American, and I'm also Muslim. I don't want to be either or. I'm both of them. But it's society, and we just got to stand up for what we believe in.
What's next for you on this issue?
Just to support our small organizations that are helping, not just as Muslims or immigrants or refugees, just supporting every little organization, standing for equality, standing up for people, helping each other out. It's the small things that you do that will change people's lives. It's the small things that will get us together and make a change.
All right. Well, thank you for speaking with me today, Ilaf Al-Tamimi.
Thank you so much for everything and honoring us and giving me the chance to speak. It's been an honor. Thank you so much.
So, Marisa, what's the status of the travel ban now?
So, the third version went into effect. The Supreme Court allowed it at the beginning of December. And so restrictions are in place on travel from Iran, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Chad, North Korea, and also some folks from Venezuela.
You know, Marisa, when I hear that, it makes me think of all the international students that we have at UNM and NMSU, students who are studying, who that really might change some of their plans, their ability to maybe go home and visit family.
Absolutely. And I think that we've heard that around the country as folks are really evaluating what their next steps are in this country or with their own educations. There's a lot of ways that this creates uncertainty for the future.
And later in the year, in the summer, the United States also threatened to deport hundreds of Iraqi nationals, no matter how long they'd lived in the country. Here in New Mexico, Kadeem Abu Mohammed was being threatened with deportation, even though he'd helped the U.S. military for years and faced persecution, torture, and death back in Iraq because of it. KUNM spoke with Kadeem in Albuquerque as he awaited possible deportation.
I'm like you guys, I have family, I have kids, you know, please let me do my job as a father, as a person from this country. They are suffering over there. Trust me, if some person is not suffering his country, he's not be crossing the border. When you cross the border, you're dreaming about another life. Trust me, if you have a good life in your country, you're not coming.
So the buzzword this year in all of our coverage was uncertainty. And that uncertainty was really hard for Abu Mohammed's family. Here's his daughter, Courtney.
I don't know, I try to spend every minute with him, but like, it's hard because it's like, I don't want these to be the last minutes and I don't want to be sad or cry because I cry a lot now. It's just hard. I'm really optimistic and I think in the future a lot. So it's like hard to think that I have one more year of high school and like, I don't know, is he going to be there? It's like, I don't know, I don't even know what's going to happen in 2 days.
That is a lot of pain in her voice. Marisa, where is Kadeem today?
He ended up not reporting for deportation, so he has some health issues, and there was concern that if he was held in a detention facility as battles were waged in courts over whether or not these folks were going to get deported, all of these Iraqi nationals around the country, that while he waited, that his health would really deteriorate. So he didn't report, and he is still living in sanctuary. You know, he can't leave where he's at. So his attorney, Rebecca Kitson, described it as him kind of being almost like incarcerated in a church. I mean, it's much nicer than incarceration, but his mobility is limited. He can't leave the place.
He's settled in with the church community. His application through both his wife and his son remained pending. So those, unfortunately, are just stuck in the regular bureaucratic process. Of course, the Hamama litigation has continued, you know, nationwide as far as working to get people released from detention. And so all that litigation has kind of been occurring in the background. The year for me has been one of sort of reassessing expectations for what success means. Before, we were able to use more of an educated guess in order to be able to know when cases were going to get approved, for example. And now we have to work in a greater realm of uncertainty. Sometimes success is not necessarily getting something approved, but is preventing something bad from happening. There have been really significant shifts across the field in all areas across the spectrum of immigration law. My clients will ask me, well, has the law changed? And it's like, no, the law hasn't changed, but procedure has changed, and the interpretation of it has changed, and the way that the law is enforced has changed. Immigration calls into question lines of race and class and ethnicity and religion, because if you're talking about, you know, a true melting pot of people in the intersection of different cultures, it brings up all those issues necessarily. It can bring up some of the beauty of that concept when we have people who naturalize, become part of the country, give their gift back, whatever. But I think it also brings up the ugliness when we see things like the travel ban, back and forth, racism, nationalism, all that sort of thing can easily raise its ugly head as well.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico's end-of-year show. I'm your host, Sarah Gustavus. We're talking about the intersection of race, culture, and politics in 2017. And we are not taking calls today, but we always welcome your comments online at KUNM.org. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook, or send us an email at letstalk@KUNM.org. KUNM's news team spent the last couple of weeks talking to folks around Albuquerque about their thoughts on race and politics in 2017. Here's what our reporters found.
My name is Troy Ward. I'm finishing law school, and I'm up here turning in my bar application for the New Mexico bar exam. I don't think they're more racially charged than they were. I think they're more negatively charged than they were before the election of Donald Trump. I mean, like, physical violence and people acting out these racist ideals and attitudes. I haven't seen anything personally. Of course, the media is full of racially charged violence. I think the two terms of Barack Obama scared white people. To put it bluntly, a certain segment of white people are reacting in this way to try to preserve whatever power they think they hold or that they're going to lose as America changes. I would like to see the current leadership in this country stop trying to charge things racially. You know, folks that aren't necessarily catering to this right-wing nationalistic stuff. I would like to see a lot more unity there. Get off your butts about the last election and do something positive.
John Peace, I do administration work in Albuquerque. I just think we're moving things back in the right direction. We destroyed things over the last 8 years, and we're correcting course and getting back where we need to be. By dividing people over the last 8 years, we've basically allowed ourselves, as far as government goes, to control people more in what they think and what they move forward doing. You know, I want to get back to the days where we're all considered Americans before the color of our skin, because really the color of our skin doesn't really matter when it comes down to things. We're all Americans. We're all here in this together. We should all be treating each other with respect, regardless of race, religion, all that stuff.
My name is Christina Manuelito, and I stay here in Albuquerque, but I'm originally from Tohatchee, New Mexico, which is on the Navajo Reservation.
I think a lot of it, with all the stuff that's going on and the natural disasters and the politics going on, I think we all want to have our separate corners, but I think it really just brings us all together. It's not us against the white people. We're all a different color. The reason why it's so much in the media now is because people want us to be separate and fight against each other, but it's not doing that. And that's going to come out. It's just we have more information at our hands, and people have that at their fingertips with our phones and computers, and we have more access. I think that's all that's different. As a tribal member, I think a lot of it goes over us. We're not involved in it. But now that I'm living in a city, yes, it does involve us. The homeless people just down the street, they're of all different colors. I could easily be there as well as they're there. You could be there as well as they're there. So we need to support each other and not try to step on each other to get to the top. That doesn't help anybody.
My name is Emil Sommelad. I'm from Albuquerque. I am retired. Look at the election for mayor. Purely a racial thing, I feel, by that percentage of the population that felt that they had a vote the way they did. And the idiot that we've got for mayor now that wants to have the sanctuary city and all of the ilk that comes with sanctuary cities. It's getting to where families can't have an honest discussion about all that's going on without having very serious dialogue. You can't have a friendly discussion anymore. As growing up, I'm 75, and you know, we could discuss politics. You know, my father was a Democrat, a Roosevelt Democrat during the Depression, and we had good discussions. Nowadays, you can't have that. You can't. It gets too riled up. If a white male says something, he's immediately anti-gay, anti-this, anti-that. You can't have just a plain opinion about something without being called prejudiced.
Hi, I'm Carolyn Reynolds. I'm a substitute teacher and a pet sitter, and I live in Corrales. Well, there's a lot of racial diversity here for certain compared to other states. I definitely have a hard time watching the news these days, so, or listening to it, so I just think that it's alienating. I think we just saw a group of people on the street on Paseo with a swastika, and it's alarming. I'm Jewish, so, you know, I don't feel, you know, at this point that it's the same kind of threat as it was in Europe. I think it might be more of a threat to people of color, but I really don't know for sure. But I think it's terrifying. You know, I have a lot of feelings about the idea that people don't deserve to be here. I feel, you know, unless you're Native American, you're an immigrant. Your family immigrated at some point or another, and I think it's very hypocritical to say that immigrants shouldn't be welcome. All people have a right to be here and to be safe. So I see that as being threatened, and I'm deeply offended, and also as a white person feel I don't want to be clumped in to the people who behave that way either. I want to support, but I also don't want to be seen as a villain.
My name is William King. I'm retired. I do missionary work, like for Trump, because he seems like he's trying to bring in God back into our country. I never seen so much lying and hatred. We hate each other. I mean, the Democrats hate the Republicans, and the Republicans hate the Democrats. The fight we have amongst each other, it's terrible. There are too many people, even my friends, that I can't believe that still are prejudiced like that.
My name is Heather Fredrickson. My family own the business, All Sports Trophies. I try to stay away from politics. You know, I have friends on both sides and in between. And, you know, I just don't make our friendships about that. I ignore political posts. I don't get into arguments with people. I think social media fuels it because you can hide behind a keyboard and a screen. New Mexico, I think, has always been kind of politically charged, in my opinion. I couldn't really tell you why, just from what you see and hear, even without seeking it out. I think the media fuels a lot of this. A lot of the white supremacists, the Black Lives Matter, the people hating the Black Lives Matter, the people hating the white supremacists, the people hating Hillary Clinton, the people, I think the media fuels it. I think they throw gas on a fire that doesn't need to be thrown on a fire. Be nice to people. And if someone's not nice to you, just have the courage and the wherewithal to walk away. You're not going to change them. They're not going to change you. You just deal with it and accept that's how they are. And you don't have to be their friend. You don't have to be their enemy. You just, it can be non. You know, we don't have to hate each other.
My name is Sean Jordan, and I work in healthcare, and I do work here in the downtown area. People need to take responsibility for where they are in their lives and not blame others. Instead of saying, well, I can't get anywhere because they give all this to the Hispanics, or they give all this to, you know what I mean, this person. It's very divisive. I won't get political, but our president is a piece of trash, and I am quite embarrassed to be an American and have such a president. I think it really does affect us because everybody needs to learn how to live together and how to proceed together to some sort of better state of living.
Thanks to KUNM's Mellory Begay, Victor Onimole, Sarah Trujillo, and Elaine Baumgartel for doing those interviews. During Trump's campaign and in his first year in office, we really saw a shift in the rhetoric around immigration.
On day one, we will begin working on an impenetrable, physical, tall, powerful, beautiful southern border wall.
KUNM reporter Marisa DeMarco is in studio with me today. She's covered a lot of these issues. Marisa, how did those campaign promises play out this year?
There's no wall yet, for one, but that's still a cornerstone of Trump's national security plan. And the procedures changed down at the Immigration and Customs Enforcement as well. They stopped prioritizing certain kinds of cases and just developed a policy of cracking down in a general way. And we heard of raids that happened in Albuquerque and Santa Fe and Las Cruces.
Yeah. You did a story this year about Alejandro Cano, a dad who was deported. And because no one here in the U.S. could take care of his child, who was a U.S. citizen, he had to take her with him. Here's Cano and his daughter, Serenity.
And I'm going to Mexico. And I want to stay there forever.
Yeah?
Because immigration said that we need to go to Mexico. That's why we have everything packed up.
Some moments she's willing to go to Mexico and all that. And then she started getting nervous and getting confused, no? I'm just happy for all those years I've been here. I met beautiful people. I've been living these last years so happy. The best time of my life.
Do we know what ended up happening to them?
I don't. I know that Cano, I spoke to him just a couple of days before he reported to the ICE facility in El Paso. And he wasn't able to work with an attorney really, or the Mexican consulate, because things were just happening so quickly for him. So there's nobody here that I can really reach out to. I did call his cell phone number again, and I can't tell if it's still his number or not. So I don't actually know.
We talked about protests a few minutes ago. There were also these May Day demonstrations. What happened there?
New Mexico's immigrant rights community has a lot of pride in the history in this state of pushing back against anti-immigrant policies and anti-immigration policies. And so we saw this year on May Day, hundreds of businesses closed their door. I think almost 200 businesses closed their doors for the day.
Cristina Beauty Salon, Danelli Furniture, Discoteca Deportes.
And they had this huge event down at Tigway Park in Albuquerque, where there was really an intersection of talking about workers' rights, as well as educational rights and immigrant rights.
And they talked about this big lawsuit that went to trial in Santa Fe over the summer. And the lawsuit argues that students of color, children from families with low incomes, and English language learners aren't given sufficient education or access to equal education around the state. Here's Myra Acevedo with Partnership for Community Action. KUNM spoke with her while covering this issue.
Everybody wants their child to be successful. Nobody wants their child to not finish high school. Our state is one in the nation with a fund that can save our children, but we refuse. We need to start thinking about, as we are preparing our children for the workforce, what opportunities can we start forming in our state so that it's a viable state?
Funding for education, whether to tap the permanent fund, these are all issues that we hear a lot of talk about in Santa Fe every year. Has there been a decision in that lawsuit?
No, not yet. We're still waiting to hear from District Court Judge Sarah Singleton. The lawsuit brings up a lot of those questions about how we fund public school here in New Mexico and whether we can find a way to fund it adequately. But also, the lawsuit talks about racial and ethnic disparities in public schools, which I don't think gets talked about a ton here otherwise.
And in the fall of 2017, all over the country, including here in New Mexico at UNM, campuses erupted in protest when President Trump announced the end of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that's commonly known as DACA.
Yeah, there were huge turnouts at campuses all over the state. Here is DACA recipient Yasmin Irasoki Ruiz.
The very first thing that people need to do is stop talking about us without us. They need to bring the people who are directly affected to the table, because we know what our community is facing and we know what the solutions are. Only 800,000 people were covered with DACA. That means our families were not covered with DACA. And now is the time that we need to come together and continue to fight for more than DACA.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico's Year in Review show. I'm Sarah Gustavus. This hour, we're talking about the atmosphere in the United States around race and politics and how national policies landed in New Mexico.
Can't drink oil!
Keep it in the soil!
Can't drink oil!
Keep it in the soil!
One of the biggest environmental stories actually started last year in North Dakota and continued into this year. Many people from the Southwest traveled to attempt to block the Dakota Access Pipeline project. The National Guard and various local law enforcement agencies evicted the water protectors at Standing Rock in February. Here in Albuquerque, demonstrations cropped up around town. Here's Cody Artis.
A lot of the economic power lies in the banks, and once we get the banks to divest, we create a little chain reaction that goes down the line and affects a lot of big oil companies. As an indigenous person, we're always fighting since day one, since you're born. Our lands will always be at stake.
The movement carried on around the country, and there were efforts to protect other natural places and sacred places and monuments, right, Sarah?
Right. The thing to watch now is that there are several tribes, including the Navajo Nation, the Ute tribes, Ute Mountain Ute and Zuni and Hopi. They filed lawsuits to stop the redesignation of Bear's Ears, which is a sacred place for those tribes, from being scaled back. And we'll see. Have to wait and see what happens next year with that.
There's also been some efforts to protect Chaco Canyon here at home. I got a chance to talk to Elga Garza of Ayoyotes on the Ground, who went to Standing Rock many times and then returned just recently for a healing reunion.
We are known as Mexica Chichimecas, also known as Aztecas. We are from Central Mexico, but our migration stories have us all the way from the Gilas to Veracruz into Central Texas. We were on the supply run because the camps could not survive without that constant supplies coming in. And what we did here in the 505 is that we worked a lot also with the Pueblo Alliance and others that had family members there. So we were always checking in on each other's camps, always taking messages back and forth, always reassuring families that everybody was okay, sending letters back and forth. And so all of those were very, very important pieces to the longevity all those months in those camps.
And were you at the eviction in February, or had you already come home?
We were there 2 days before the actual eviction. We still had family and friends in the camp, and we also had a lot of our camp supplies there. They had already announced the roadblocks, they were set up, they were also really coming down on if you were going back into the camp, you couldn't have water, you couldn't have extra sleeping bags, you couldn't have extra luggage, all those things were questioned. We were able to get in, and it was a very hard scene to watch. So there was a lot of chaos, there was still a lot of uncertainty, but the call was still out. We knew people were staying to the end. I mean, I had my children, my grandchildren, we were all there throughout these months. But one thing that experience did reinforce is the powers that be and the control that they have. They control media, they control the airwaves. When they were bulldozing out, when they were smudging out the treaty camp for 4 hours, nobody had contact. So in many ways, it just reinforced what we already knew, the control that there is, and the fact that the U.S. government was raising arms against an unarmed camp that were U.S. citizens on treaty land.
How do you think the experience in North Dakota changed you, if it did at all?
It made me a lot stronger. It made me a lot more focused. I've been through a lot in my life. In the southernmost tip of Brownsville-Matamoros border, we were in a militarized zone for 13 years. So when I went to the camp, it was reliving that again, the helicopters, the football stadium lights, the checkpoints, the surveillance. How it has changed me, like many others, it's the awakening. The awakening of what our reality is. And it's an awakening to find the solutions. And it's an awakening that we're on call. And we're going to be on call for generations to come.
You know, there's always been a lot of activism around Chaco Canyon. Do you think what happened in North Dakota is reinforcing that fight?
Oh, yes. It's reinforcing all of the fights that we've been in for years. And it's also bringing to light the new battles, like in taking over monument land for exploration and drilling. Those are some of the biggest fights that we have coming up, too, you know, the continued destruction of those sacred sites. And sacred sites are everywhere because it's our earth, it's our mother, and we live and survive from that.
Marisa, do you think this was a year when we felt the national politics affecting people maybe more strongly than ever before?
You know, it can be really hard to say, but I've never really experienced a year where I was watching so closely every day what was coming down from national politicians to see what stories were going to be happening immediately that day in New Mexico. And, you know, sometimes the whole country started having a debate that New Mexico's been having for a while, like with the conversation around statues and what gets memorialized.
KUNM's Elaine Baumgartel talked with Myris Chino, an artist and activist from Acoma Pueblo, on Let's Talk New Mexico about celebrating brutal conquistadors.
I think because of the way the education system is set up in New Mexico, a lot of that has been glossed over and a lot of it has been very romanticized, and we saw the conquistador history as heroic, which it is not. I believe that celebrating the brutal occupation of our beloved lands has become so ingrained into the psyche of Hispanics and non-Hispanic Hispanophiles that they don't even recognize the racism. And if they do, or worse, if they do recognize the racism, then it says something a lot for this land. And I believe that because these issues now have come to the forefront again, that they're tied in with the social ills that are going on in Charlottesville, Virginia. But I believe that there really is no difference between the conquistador lie and the Confederate lie. The love of the obscene has done much damage here as it has done in the South. There's no difference.
Just a couple of weeks later, hundreds of people turned out to protest Santa Fe's La Entrada. That's a reenactment of when Diego de Vargas retook the city after the Pueblo Revolt. Demonstrators, including members of the group The Red Nation, called it a celebration of genocide.
My name is Charles Rosacker, and I was born in Santa Fe. My parents and my wife's parents were born just close to the Guadalupe Church in Santa Fe. So we go back a lot of years, and like many of us, we're of mixed blood. And the sooner we figure out that we're really one tribe, the better off we're going to be.
Donald and Winfield, the African Americans are trying to get rid of these things in history that represent a part of their life that was, you know, really bad. And the natives are saying the same thing here about fiestas, because these people are out here talking about how they conquered the Indians, you know, and took their land. And that's history now. And that's where it should be, is in the history museum, you know, not out here on the street.
Several people were arrested at that event, and the charges were all finally dropped at the end of November this year.
The future of the Entrada in Santa Fe, it's a really emotional topic. Lots of feelings on both sides, and we'll continue watching that. We're talking about charged cultural and political clashes around New Mexico in 2017. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Sarah Gustavus. The national conversation about racism, free speech, and hate speech crash landed at the University of New Mexico when Milo Yiannopoulos came to give a talk.
Yeah, that was the beginning of the year.
Marisa DeMarco from KUNM, what did you see in the protests outside the student union building?
You know, there was a couple hundred students. There was helicopters. There are always a ton of helicopters at these things. And mostly, you know, students just turned out to hold up signs and chant. At some point, I know that students were banging on the doors of the venue and also a little bit on the tables outside, but it really seemed mostly like a pretty typical demonstration.
There have been other demonstrations in the country that had turned very violent, so there was kind of a sense in the air that things could go badly that night. That's what I felt there when we were covering the event.
Yeah, and it's hard to tell where that starts. Like, does it start with the students, or does it start with the massive law enforcement presence, right? Or does it start with the really high tensions in the air?
There were dozens of law enforcement officers there from different agencies. I think a lot of people who weren't at the event didn't quite realize. At one point, I saw more officers in the lobby than I saw people coming in or out of the event.
Yeah, and when we were leaving the event, you know, we walked down this pathway where police officers were just standing really on either side.
This brings up a lot of questions about when angry speech, even racist speech, precedes violence like we saw later in the year in Charlottesville.
And like we're talking about, it also raises a ton of questions about law enforcement turnout. Taxpayers put the bill for this stuff. And just for Yiannopoulos' one night, few hour stop in Albuquerque, taxpayers spent $81,000 on law enforcement, who basically acted as security at the event.
And just a couple of months ago, the American Civil Liberties Union announced it will represent Yiannopoulos in a court case about free speech and advertising.
I caught up with Peter Simonson, who's the executive director of the local ACLU affiliate, to talk about that decision.
Certainly is a free speech issue insofar as the university might have considered any limits on Mr. Yiannopoulos' speech. Fortunately, that didn't happen. I understand the uproar that created, and I understand the outrage, and I sympathize with that outrage, actually. But nonetheless, if the university is not censoring his speech or other speakers who come to campus, then the free speech interests have been protected, I think.
And here's the question that I always run into with this. Is free speech about simply not being jailed or persecuted by the government for saying your ideas, or does it mean unfettered access to any venue at all?
No, there are certain forums within public space that are open to free expression in any way, shape, or form. Others are of a more limited nature, and the university context is of a more limited nature and can be regulated more closely safe than a sidewalk or a street corner out in public. And of course, when you get to private property, there are no free speech protections at all. So no, there isn't unfettered access. In fact, there are time, place, and manner restrictions that government can often put on speech depending upon how it serves the needs of, you know, the community's welfare.
If the university decided, hey, this is too volatile, we don't want to have this on our campus, do they not have the right to say that?
I think if they make that decision, they are necessarily discriminating on the basis of a person's viewpoint and the ideas that are being presented. And when you put government in the position, in fact, when you empower government to censor on the basis of the ideas that are being presented, I think we are handing over to government some pretty unusual and troubling authority.
You know, I attended the event in January and I spoke to a lot of the people who were outside demonstrating. And then I also went inside and spoke to people who were there in support of Yiannopoulos. But outside, a lot of folks were saying that his speech amounted to hate speech and made them feel unsafe on their own university campus. Has that become a concern for the ACLU, who is defending Yiannopoulos?
Yeah, in that context and in many others, I think we are trying to be as sensitive to those implications for our communities, and particularly communities of color, which are being particularly targeted by people like this Mr. Yiannopoulos and obviously the white supremacist, the white nationalist movement, as we've seen it unfold across the country. That doesn't get us to a place of denying free speech, though. I think it continues to advocate for a position that ensures that all sides in these matters get the opportunity to speak. If we put ourselves in the position of conceding to government the authority to censor speech, a time will come, and it may not be in the near future, but certainly in the distant future, when government will take advantage of that to censor speech in ways that I think could be very damaging to our society. I mean, you can only imagine what this administration, the presidential administration, how they would use that authority. Imagine how Southern mayors in Southern cities in the 60s and 70s might have used that authority to squelch the speech of civil rights protesters and the Black community as it was rising up. That's a kind of a situation I don't think we want to visit in this country.
Yeah, so Milo Yiannopoulos obviously was just kind of the tip of the iceberg this year when it comes to xenophobia and white nationalism and white supremacy. We have seen these moments erupt in violence, right? It ends up not just being a question of speech at that point.
That's exactly right. You said it exactly right. It is then not just a question of speech, because there is no room for violence in the First Amendment. The free exchange of ideas does not provide for a free exchange of bullets or a free exchange of weapons.
Just returning briefly to the idea of law enforcement response to these moments, to these actions, when police show up en masse, right, at these events, I think there's often a sense that they're on the side of the white nationalist or the xenophobic speaker, and then the people of color who show up to object are feeling like they're the recipients of that law enforcement, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, the ACLU has jumped into situations like that. I think there is, in those moments where public safety is truly an issue, I think there is a role for police to play. But surely they can do that in such a way that they do not either convey the impression to protesters or, in fact, act out on their own viewpoints in a way that would censor the speech in a protest moment like that.
All right. Well, thank you, Peter Simonson.
Sure. Thank you.
That Yiannopoulos event was part of what helped me form a question this year, which is, who calls police? Who feels like the police force is there to protect them? And who feels like the police are there to police them? We had a Let's Talk New Mexico show on that topic. This is Andal Bui, the social services director for the New Mexico Asian Family Center.
It's not that easy for our community members to call in and just ask for help from the police.
And you've heard stories from people about tough interactions with officers. What goes wrong typically?
When they, you know, do call the police, they're not able to communicate with the police. And when the police does come and they're not able to communicate because of the language barrier, there's no one there to help them to communicate and to tell the police officer what's going on and what had happened to them. And a lot of time they use either just people that are around or even the perpetrator who had hurt them to interpret for them. And so they don't really have any trust in calling the police to get help for them.
I think there's still a lot that's unknown about the long-term impacts of what's happening today that we're going to see in New Mexico in the future. I mean, this is certainly not new that some communities don't feel comfortable calling the police, but it does seem to have a different tone in 2017. It's changed in some ways. I'm not sure exactly how, but there's something different about it.
Yeah, and I think you can also look at that interaction as being the tip. So she's talking about in that clip having a distrust or a nervousness about calling for police, but that would extend then to other kinds of ways that you're not comfortable interacting with the government.
It was a big year with new developments happening fast as policies came down from the president and tensions around race, class, and gender showed up in protests and demonstrations and conversations between people. With that fast pace, it can be hard to pull back and take a look at the bigger picture sometimes. What does that feel like for you as a reporter?
Yeah, as a reporter, you know, we're just running from story to story to story. You're looking at the news every day and just trying to make sure that you are catching, you know, what's happening and the big effects that it's having on your community. So, you know, I tend to really zero in on the details when I'm in that mode. But I got a chance to chat with Andrea Mays, who's an American Studies scholar here, about a bigger picture.
This fundamental shift in the narrative about who we are as a country, what we do, what promise America provides, and the lines around issues of belonging and race and nationality and opportunity are being drawn in harsher and more stark terms in the U.S. every day.
So a lot of people are feeling this conversation just turning to race more consistently and maybe more directly. Mm-hmm. And there's also this rising, like, frustration sometimes among people who just don't want to hear it about race anymore.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I realize that you're probably in a privileged position if you can decide that you just don't want to think about that today. But I do sense a lot of kind of turning away from the racial aspect of the conversation because people are getting fed up.
And there's an interesting irony that's going on with that, right? People are getting fed up. We're talking about political scientists are saying we're in one of the most polarized moments in U.S. political history. But at the same time, people are turning away from it. We have certain factions in high office in the United States who are drawing attention to it. And that is what creates the negative tension around it. The baiting language, for instance, our president recently called Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas at a Native American event. People are happy or not happy, but are comfortable saying, well, that wasn't really racial. Well, yeah, it is, right? There's no way that's not racial. You know, in the Charlottesville incident as an incident where some people chose not to see the ways that this was potentially and ultimately politically explosive, not despite the fact that it was racial, but because this was, you know, a very racially charged moment in American politics. And to just say, well, you know, that wasn't really what it was about. That wasn't really what our leaders needed to deal with. We have 200 years of history, 250 years of history. We fought the Civil War over race, right? Over freedom on racialized terms. And there are people who were systematically strung up to trees and lynched at the turn of the 20th century based on policing and terrorizing people so that they would know their place as racialized subjects. When we have people showing up in riot gear to march in a Confederate state against changes to monuments commemorating Confederate heroes, how can that not be about race? And how can we not be real careful and real sensitive about how we confront that and deal with that and call it out and say, listen, this is what this is about. And if you're unclear about the significance of some of these monuments, don't look at the monument as the place you need to learn your history. Pick up a history book and understand the broader significance of these monuments so that you understand what the implications may be for others, not just for you. People are talking out of both sides of their mouths right now around issues of race. They're baiting people to get upset about race or to feel alienated societally about race. At the same time, they're saying, I don't want to hear about race. Is it really race that they don't want to hear about? Or is it about owning what we've all lived with for a long time in this country? And what we've all lived with for a long time in this country is what race and racial difference means. And what race and racial difference means is what opportunities you get, what access you have, what sense of belonging you have, what sense of visibility you have in terms of being recognized and respected. It's not only about race. No, it's about everything that's tied to race or these constructions of race.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today, Andrea Mays.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Thank you for joining us today for Let's Talk New Mexico's Year in Review. You can find links to all of these stories online at KUNM.org. KUNM's Marisa DeMarco was in studio with me today, helping to touch on just some of the things that happened this year. We couldn't get to everything, but we talk about these issues and more on this show and in KUNM's news coverage all year long. If you'd like to see us take this conversation further or touch on other topics, send an email to letstalk@kunm.org. We always appreciate your feedback, news tips, and ideas. Let's Talk New Mexico will return in the new year on January 11th with the show I'm going to host about the upcoming legislative session. If you missed any of this program or would like to share it with friends, it's also posted on our website. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. I'm Sarah Gustavus. This is KUNM.